This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So our panel is on debt forgiveness, and I have with me some exceptional leaders and thinkers, people who actually have thought about this a lot and are involved in it. Judge Weedoff, I've introduced to you, and I hope he's coming back. And just a reminder, he'll be leading a newly formed commission in the American Bankruptcy Institute to study the laws that affect consumer bankruptcy and to make recommendations to Congress. That'll be a multi-year task, and I think it will hopefully change the shape of American law in a way that, as we're going to talk about, desperately needs to be changed. Judge Shelley Chapman is sitting to my left. She's a bankruptcy judge for the Southern District of New York. For those of you who are not bankruptcy geeks, that's probably the most important bankruptcy court in the world. And of course,
he had to say that before Gene came back in the room.
I meant other than Chicago, of course. And Judge Chapman has sat on hundreds, thousands of major bankruptcy cases and has witnessed firsthand a lot of what's going on in consumer bankruptcy law. Rabbi Friedman teaches at Harvard. He's got a PhD candidate in what, Near Eastern Languages and the Civilization Department, and has given a lot of thought to the topics that we're going to talk about today. Irv Nathan, a rare honor to have him with us today. He was recently was the Attorney General of the city of Washington, D.C., General Counsel for the House of Representatives, I'm not going to say anything, and he's now a founder and a board member of SEDEC, a nonprofit legal organization dedicated to assisting low-income D.C. residents. So each of our panel members has a very unique experience and are profoundly involved in the business or the art of debt forgiveness. And the problem of credit, of loans, of poverty is really the stuff of their daily life. So they'll be in a position to give us some very unique insights. Now, why we're having a debt forgiveness panel is a question that's kind of near and dear to my heart. I am a bankruptcy lawyer. How that happened in life, I don't know. I don't think when I started law school, I knew there was something called bankruptcy. But here I am 40-some years later. I think bankruptcy, and we're going to talk more that it's not just about bankruptcy. It's about economics. It's about poverty. It's about consumers. It's about debt. It's about credit. These are really the topics we want to talk about. But debt forgiveness is really an economic and political issue that I think touches at the very heart of everything that's going on around us today. And the first thing that I noticed, not the first thing, and maybe I should restate that, one of the things I've come to realize that bothers me the most and why in part we're having this entire program is what I call the asymmetry of bankruptcy law. And the asymmetry, it became clear to me, and you folks have probably heard more about bankruptcy because of the last election, that bankruptcy is now for the top 1%. And when I went to law school, bankruptcy was considered something for people who were in economic trouble and for the poor. Now it's no longer a stigma, and it's actually a very effective tool for the very wealthy and a very ineffective tool for those who are the neediest. And we'll get to that toward the midpoint of our discussion about what happened to Congress in 2005 and how bankruptcy laws took a major sea change. And I think part of what Judge Weedoff and others are interested in doing is getting us back to where we were. I guess the other thing I want to comment on is that when I think of bankruptcy, when I think of what's going on in our economy, when I think of the moral economy, and you heard about Shakespeare, so my literary allusion here is really a tale of two cities and the play Les Miserables, and which always frightens me when I see it, not because it's frightening and the way they do it in Broadway, but it is. But, that's the story of Jean Valjean, who has stolen some bread, and he goes to prison, and he spends 19 years in prison because he's stolen a loaf of bread, and he escapes, and he's pursued by Inspector Javert. Is that the way you pronounce it, you French people? French-speaking people. And it's a ruthless pursuit, of somebody who is indebted for a very modest amount for something that was stolen for a very good reason. And I find something about that very frightening, because I am afraid that we are, in a cultural, legal, and economic way, you know, we're moving back in that direction. I see Inspector Javert re-arising himself metaphorically in our economic society. So I'm concerned about that. And that concern is what led in part to this conference and to this particular topic. So how are we going to approach it? Well, I'm an adjunct at Georgetown, and I always tell my students, we're going to look at the arc of law, the arc of history, and then I pretend there is such a thing. So we're going to kind of look at where did the idea of credit begin? Where did the idea of money begin? Because, you know, it's all fictional. There is really no such thing as money and credit. It's an intangible. We just make it up. You know, I have credits in a bank account. I don't know why. I mean, they're there for some reason. So debt and credit are two intangible metaphoric things for some other concept. But we're going to study how we've moved from biblical notions of debt and biblical notions of debt forgiveness. And then we're going to move and take a look at some what happened in America when the Constitution was first written, and what did some of the founders have to say about bankruptcy law. How do we move into areas of a very liberal discharge? And how do we wind up where we are today, where the notions of discharge and fresh start have really become, I think, minimized? So for that, I think I'm going to start with...
So can I interrupt you?
Yeah, in fact, feel free. This is a conversation. And Judge Chapman, I know you're always free to interrupt me.
So David said metaphorically... and I just, one of my goals today, besides getting a word in edgewise with this very formidable lineup, is to make you leave here feeling as uncomfortable as possible about what's happening in the country. Because I think that, to pick up on a theme that we started with today, is that will form the basis of action. So when David said metaphorically, I want to challenge that. I want to ask you the following question. How many people here think that there is no longer debtor's prison in the United States? Okay, good answer, because there is. And one of the things that I think that certainly Judge Weedoff and I are going to talk about is why, in fact, there still is. There still are people in jail for the equivalent of stealing bread and even less. So,
yeah, no, I agree. And so
interruption ended.
No, but you know, but thank you, because I think you're agreeing with me. So Les Miserables is still here. It's not a play about the 19th or 18th century. It's not a play about the French Revolution.
Could I ask the judge, could you explain what you mean?
Yes.
I'm not familiar with the situation.
So what I mean is there, and I don't want to, I really don't want to hijack the arc of the panel, but just because I think ordinary people don't understand actually in a very granular way the indignities and all the terrible things that poor people suffer. So if you get arrested, in the Bronx. Why? Because you're in the wrong place at the wrong time. You didn't do anything. Here's what can happen to you just because you've gotten arrested. You can lose your job. If you're in public housing, or if you live with someone who's in public housing, you can lose your public housing. Then what happens? You want to get out of the system as quickly as possible, so you agree to a plea deal. That involves paying money. Well, why did you get in the situation you were in to begin with? Because you're poor. So then, if you can't pay the money to pay for your supervision, your parole services, which have been outsourced or which the government is charging you for, they go and arrest you and they put you in prison. So you're being put in prison for the non-payment of a debt that you incurred because you were maintaining your innocence for something that you didn't do.
That's Les Miserables.
Yeah.
So
that's the point that I wanted to make, is that I think that, you know, from time to time you see this discussed, and that generally speaking, folks don't understand this web and this pull this, even as people start to try to rise up out of poverty, there's just this incredible web of things that operates in insidious ways to pull them back down. So that's, you know, I could give other examples, but again, I'm going to now stop talking.
All right, but that's so. No, well, you're helping to set the stage. So we're trying to explore the origins and the notions of debt forgiveness as a moral and biblical principle, and Rabbi Friedman's going to help us do that in a minute. Because when we come to the 20th or 21st century, you know, we really have to ask, is debt forgiveness a morally and politically and economically mandated outcome? That we really must do it, because if we don't, we will have revolution and insurrection, and it's really untenable. So I'll just tell you, when I first became a bankruptcy lawyer, I worked with very wealthy real estate developers who were extraordinarily smart people who owed huge amounts of money on real estate that they couldn't repay. So what did I learn? I learned two things: that they had what's called non-recourse debt. Anyone know what that is? That means that the bank only agrees to look to the real estate and not to the person, and that they could restructure their debt and go on with their life totally free. And I remember saying to my colleagues, if you can build Trump Towers non-recourse, why can't I build it? Because if you're not on the debt, then there's no risk. And I soon learned that for those who are at the opposite end of the economic pole, it was the situation that Judge Chapman is explaining. You can lose everything, your driver's license, your livelihood. And for the wealthy, there is actually very little risk. So we had that's where we wind up. Let's go back to where we want to start. So Rabbi Friedman, you talk about what you want, but you mentioned to me you'd read a great book by David Graeber called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And I thought, wow, can we cover that in 3 minutes? But
no.
But I think also, you told me, and I think this is worth getting into, in Jewish thinking, BCE, there were very defined notions of debt forgiveness. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Great. Yeah. So everything old is new again, and sadly, some of the old things are not yet new, but we're working on it, hopefully. So I'm going to try and give a perspective here about the history of debt for the last 5,000 years. One thing I just want to point out, that the point that that David Graeber makes in his book, is that the economic model that we think of human culture as having followed is wrong. So we think that things started out with barter. I have two arrowheads, you have a spear, right? You need the arrowheads, I need the spear, we make an exchange, right? And it's only when those individual transactions kind of got out of whack. I have the arrowheads, you have the spear, but I don't need the spear right now, and you don't need the arrowheads right now. All right, so then we make up money, and then we make up credit to cover the money. And that's totally wrong. There's no human society, as far as anthropologists know, that ever functioned that way. In fact, credit is the way that we all function as people. And this was a point made already in the 1920s by French anthropologist Marcel Mauss in the book The Gift, in which he points out that really the way society works is, you need something, I provide it for you, and because we live in close human community and have a connection, 6 months later when I need something from you, then that debt, quote unquote, gets repaid, right? And so that actually we all live our lives that way, and that's really the fundamental way that all human societies function. Money and formal systems of credit come about when the relative value isn't quite clear, right? The value of the favor that I did and the number of fish that's going to be worth in 6 months starts to get out of whack. We can't agree about it. So then we use money to kind of talk about value in that way. And then only as society starts to become urbanized and anonymous and kind of pull apart do we see these notions of the debt that you owe me, I'm going to exact it from you in a very exacting way. Okay, so that's sort of the anthropologist's view of the history of debt. I just did 5,000 years in 2 minutes, so you're welcome. But really what I want to do is look at some texts here, because I think there's actually some quite stunning notions in antiquity that we may have lost. So I actually want to start not with the Hebrew Bible, but I want to start with the ancient Near Eastern context. The laws of Ur-Nammu, from Ur, about 2100 BCE. So what we find in a lot of these ancient Near Eastern law codes is there's a prologue in which the new king or the new leader talks about how great they are and all the great things they're going to do for the people. So here's what he says.
Sounds familiar.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Whether, great again.
Right, and whether it happened or not, we don't know yet. So in this prologue, which is the first source up there on the screen, he says, I did not deliver the orphan to the rich. I did not deliver the widow to the mighty. I did not deliver the man with but one shekel to the man with one mina. And a mina is 60 shekel. Right? So someone who has 60 times someone else's wealth, right? I didn't, right, I protected the poorer person in that circumstance. I did not deliver the man with but one sheep to the man with the ox. I established justice in the land. So what's interesting about this text is you could read it as the poor person is innocent, the orphan is innocent, the widow is innocent, and those mightier and wealthier than they are trying to exploit them, and I protected them. But I want to read this text, or suggest we could read this text more radically, which is, the guy with one shekel owed some money to the guy with 60 shekel, and yet the king said no. And yet, perhaps the king said, you know what? When you have one shekel and you have 60 shekel, even if the guy with one shekel owes you some money, just forget about it. That's the best way that we're going to create justice in this society. And I want to skip ahead to, I think, a much later text from a much different period and a much different genre that reflects on this as well. So I'm now skipping ahead from the year 2100 BCE to the year, let's say, 200 CE, from Babylonian polytheists to rabbinic monotheists. And it's a legal text called the Tosefta. You heard about the Mishnah before. The Tosefta are the same people writing at the same time, just their stuff didn't make it in. But it's still a good book nonetheless. So this text is dealing with a distinction between justice and righteousness. And it says like this: if a case was adjudicated and the innocent exonerated and the guilty convicted. Okay, so justice was done according to this text, right? Party A stole something from Party B, and the court gave the stuff that Party A stole back to Party B. Justice has been done. But has it been? If he, meaning the judge, convicted a poor person, the judge should remove the poor person from the courtroom and give the poor person of the judge's own money. Now remember what just happened here. A poor person committed a crime, stole something from a rich person, and nevertheless we recognize, or the rabbis recognized, that that may have been just, but it wasn't right. And they say that explicitly. Thus will he, meaning the judge, have done righteousness with this one, i.e. for the poor person, who clearly stole because he needed the thing, right? So the judge pays him what he needed, which I think says something about the view of the judge in society and society's role. The poor person stole because the society had failed. How do we fix it? Well, that's the judge's job, to pay out of his own pocket. So in that case, justice, righteousness will have been done for the poor person, and justice for the rich one, because the rich one shouldn't have lost the object that the poor person stole. Right? I think this is a very different way of thinking about what's happening in these economic transactions than we often think about nowadays, where we think in terms of justice without thinking in terms of righteousness. And by the way, that's not unique to us. There's a second position, which is, I'd have to scroll down for you to see it, but I'll read it for you. Rabbi Judah the prince, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, says, no, if you adjudicate the case and the innocent party is exonerated and the guilty is convicted, then you've done righteousness by removing the stolen object from the guilty person, and you've done justice by giving that stolen object back to its rightful owner. In other words, that's a position that I think accords much more with how we actually live in our legal society, which is we try to get the property reallocated properly, without taking into account the economic context of the people.
It's the definitions of property that we started out with this morning.
Exactly.
What's mine is mine, what yours is yours. That's justice and righteousness according to one view. Mm-hmm. It's not
right.
According
it's
to
Sodom
another.
According to the other view. Exactly right. Good. I wanted to start with those two texts from antiquity, right? Two very different societies separated by 2,000 odd years, right, to point out that there are different notions out there of justice and righteousness and the ways in which they should interact. right? That protection of the poor is actually deeply embedded in these ancient law codes in ways that I think we might find surprising, particularly for those who treat them as primitive, right? Maybe what's primitive was not so primitive after all. So I think what I'll do now is kind of run through some of the Jewish material, some of the biblical material.
I think the point, one of the things I want to emphasize, we're talking really about two related concepts. One is poverty, and the other one is debt forgiveness. They're not necessarily the same. Mm-hmm. And I think what you had pointed out to me earlier, and I'd like for you to talk about now, is that the notion of forgiving debt in a credit-based world really arose very early in Jewish thinking, you know, aside from the need to be just to the poor. By the way, I thought I wouldn't want to be a judge back in those days. thinking about that, Judge, it seemed to me like not a good job. So in early biblical period, tell us about what were the theories about debt forgiveness that arose in biblical period?
Great. So in general, in the ancient Near East, loans were given with interest, 20% for money, 33% for food. And the sense was that you had to repay your debts and with interest. The Hebrew Bible goes in a totally different direction. First, it requires interest-free lending in the book of Exodus for the poor specifically. And it's interesting to note that the poor there are referred to as God's people. God has some special relationship with the poor, which justifies that protection, right? Interest-free lending isn't lending, it's gifting, basically, right? On the assumption that eventually you'll get your money back, but that text itself says, and you're also not allowed to act as a creditor towards them, i.e. you're not allowed to press them for the money, right? So you give them money, you're not allowed to charge interest, and you can't request the money back, right? So it's basically a gift dressed up as a loan, possibly for the purposes of preserving their dignity, right? So that's one form of protection. The other forms of protection that we find are several mechanisms to just cancel debts outright. So the first is we see the institution of the Shemitah. So every 7 years, they would just cancel debts. Any outstanding loans would be totally forgiven. And the text there itself reflects on the possibility that people would say, as you get to years 5 and 6, I'm not going to lend. That would be an economically stupid decision. At which point the text turns around and says, you're evil if you say that. And if you actually lend, knowing that it's likely the loan will be canceled, God will bless you. And I think there's a couple of ways of reading God will bless you. You can read it as divine reward and punishment, or you can read it as your society is going to function well, and actually the blessing is that you're going to ultimately do better if you don't have all of these people in thrall to you in debt. Right, so I think there's an economic way of reading that as well. The other major institution was the Jubilee, which I think we've heard a lot about. People like to talk about Jubilees nowadays, right? Debt forgiveness on a massive scale. What the Jubilee was actually was not fundamentally about debt forgiveness, but was about release of people who had been enslaved due to debt and a return to some primordial original set of land holding in the land of Israel, as kind of every 49 years there would be this massive reset. So if you'd become poor and enslaved through bad luck, you or more likely your descendants and your family would have another shot. So it's a little hard to figure out exactly how you would apply the lessons of that Jubilee to the contemporary world. I'm not sure what a land reset globally these days would look like. But the fundamental idea is that at some points it's important to make sure there's a regular wiping out of debt. In the ancient Near East, we have other examples of kings who would come to power and then wipe out the debts of the people that they are now newly in charge of. But for the Hebrew Bible, it was not based on the whim of a king, but on the regularity of the cycle, the 7-year cycle and the 49-year cycle.
So Robert Friedman, let me ask you a question about that. What was the... was the notion of debt forgiveness just a moral concept, or was it really a macroeconomic concept that there's a level of unsustainable debt that however we got there, it's like, you know, reparations at the end of World War I. It's a debt, but it's unsustainable and it's harmful and it really needs to go away. In biblical times, was there a recognition of the macroeconomic effect, or was it morality, or was it a little bit of both, or what was it?
Right. So I think you're asking questions that are hard to answer because they didn't have the language of macroeconomics in the way that we have it. Right. So you sort of have to tease it out of the text. When they talk about God blessing you, when they talk about treating your brother with righteousness, is the notion there that that's simply a more, right, simply, right? It's also funny, right, that we say, well, there's economics over here and morality over here. I think for the Bible, it was intimately connected, and they knew, possibly because they were still in community with each other, that indebtedness was both bad for the society and immoral, right? To treat your brother that way was immoral. And there's an interesting shift that I just want to point out in terms of the debt-free lending, which is in the book of Exodus, they talk about the poor. Loans to the poor must be given debt-free, or must be given interest-free. Seems like a loan between two economic equals, you could charge some amount of interest. By the time you got to the book of Deuteronomy, they changed the language of the commandment to don't lend your brother at interest, but you can lend to foreigners at interest. Right? Foreigners there seem to mean foreign merchants, right? So when you don't have any sort of communal relationship with the person, they're just passing through, then yeah, for the sake of good economics, you can charge those people interest. But when it comes to your brother, when it comes to the community and the sustainability of the community, there's a moral element and an economic element that are joined in that, as you said. Why is it that these kings who came to power forgave all the debts? Because they knew if they didn't, there was going to be a revolution on their hands. Right. And maybe they came to power because of a revolution, primarily surrounding debt problems.
A perception of income inequality, even back in biblical times.
Exactly.
So you also told me there was something about, we had notions of collateral, and that there were special rules about how you could foreclose or take back collateral. What were some of the notions about collateral in biblical periods?
Great. So, right. So there was still lending, right? Even though it was interest-free and they were canceled, right? There were still loans taken out. And even those loans were recognized as potential impingements on the dignity of the poor. So there's a very, I think, affecting verse in the book of Exodus that says, you can't take your neighbor's garment in pledge, right, as collateral. Some read it not as about collateral, but as you can't take it on the back end of the loan to get them to repay, right? You basically can't strip them of their only garment. And then the Bible screams, because what's he going to sleep in? I, God, am compassionate, right? And there's this moment, I think, where the morality kind of breaks through in the text of saying, someone so poor who's giving you their only garment as collateral for a loan, right? Or that's the only thing you can take to guarantee the repayment of the loan, you're just destroying their life, right? I think it goes back to that notion of, yes, legally he owes you the money, but what are you even thinking when you're trying to collect it in this way?
I thought you told me when they if you took somebody's night clothes as collateral, you had to return it every evening.
Every night, exactly. Right. Which also, I think, by the way, creates a certain interpersonal connection there.
Certain hygienic issues as well.
That too.
So Judge Weedoff, what about we moved to the early Christian period and Christian notions? Was there a notion of debt relief, debt forgiveness? What goes on in that period?
What I think is so interesting is that what Jesus was talking about separated morality from legality. So, typical example, he's asked if it's legitimate to pay taxes to Caesar, to the Roman government. And what he says is, render to Caesar that which is Caesar's and to God that which is God's. So there's a division here. Yes, you comply with whatever the civil law is, but you are subject to a different law. In the same way, you have a quarrel with your brother, settle it before you go to court. Because if not, then you're likely to be having a judgment entered against you and you sold into slavery. He doesn't say there's anything wrong with being sold into slavery if you're found liable in that court suit. He's saying don't get involved in the court suit in the first place. If someone takes your cloak, offer them your robe. I mean, the idea is that he's operating at a different level of morality than the civil law, and he doesn't see any need to change the civil law, but he wants people to change their moral conduct.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very perceptive in terms of the New Testament's relationship to many of these Old Testament commands in general, right? I'll sort of just read one, actually, not from the canonical Gospels, but from the Gospel of Thomas, where Jesus says, according to this gospel, if you have money, don't lend it at interest. Rather, give it to someone from whom you won't get it back. In other words, the Bible says don't lend at interest, great, but also don't take the principal back either, right? Which is obviously wouldn't lead to a functioning society or economy, but is a moral statement, right? A moral statement about your fundamental generosity.
Or you take the story of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan finds someone in need on the road. He happens to be someone who's Jewish. He takes that person to the nearest inn, makes a down payment, and then says, and I'll pay what's required when I come back if you need more money to take care of this person. Now, again, operating that way as an entire society is not likely to be effective, but that's the moral code that Jesus is suggesting. That's this notion of loving your neighbor and defining your neighbor not in terms of your immediate family or the members of your sect, but as whomever you come in contact with.
All right, so let's accelerate our time period here. So let's move to America around, let's pick a year. How about 1776, just to pick a year. And so the framers are, they're thinking about things like freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and freedom of religion and the right to have guns. And is that really in there? And so there's actually something called, there's a bankruptcy clause in the Constitution. And when I tell my law students this, they're kind of dumbfounded because to them, you know, bankruptcy is something that Donald Trump invented. But here's what struck me about when bankruptcy first comes to America is that, as I understand it, what the Constitution says is that Congress may make uniform laws affecting bankruptcy. It's actually half a sentence in a longer sentence. And that's it. And the purpose, as I've understood it, was that in colonial America, debtors would, they'd live in Virginia, they'd run up a lot of debt, they'd want to get out of that debt, so they'd move to Maryland. And the only way you could control intrastate movement of debtors was to let the federal government make a law that said you can't get out of your debts by moving from Virginia to Maryland to Connecticut. So the initial impulse, we may have biblically started with a very moral concept. By the time we get to America and they're writing the Federalist Papers, they're thinking about absconding debtors. And I guess what struck me is when we teach modern bankruptcy law today, we call it creditors' rights. We don't ever call it debtors' rights. And so the notion, when America's founded, we have a couple of bankruptcy laws. They kind of come and go. And then I guess there's a moment in our history, kind of the turning point, and Judge Weedoff, this thing called the discharge comes into American law. How does that happen?
I'm going to interrupt again. Okay. But you left out one important thing. The country was founded on debt. The country was founded, financed by foreign debt. The founding fathers went in a boat across the ocean to borrow from France in order to fund the revolution. So among not just the idea of, you know, somebody's going to borrow to buy a horse in Virginia and then go to Maryland, but this was foremost in the founders' minds that it was necessary to borrow. Why? They were kind of taking a risk there, you know? I mean, if that revolution didn't work out, it wouldn't have been so good for them. So what debt and the concept of bankruptcy and discharge is fundamentally linked with the idea of we as a society, as a people, as a moral people, we want to encourage people to take risk because out of taking risk comes good things. For example, the founding of America. But sometimes after you take a risk and you do the best that you can, you may not be able to pay back your debt. The horse that you borrowed to buy dies. So you can't plow the field, et cetera, et cetera. You ought to be able to get a discharge. But the reason that I interrupted was because it's important to understand that the premise of America involves debt, big debt, like, I won't say Trump, but corporate level significant debt as a percentage of, you know, the enterprise that was being founded in America.
But hand in hand with that is the notion that the kind of debt that we want to encourage is large scale mercantile debt. It's going to France and bringing money over that you can use to purchase weapons or supply food to an army. It's not individual personal indebtedness. And to the extent we had bankruptcy laws in the first 100 years of the United States, it was in response to economic turmoil that caused problems at that mercantile level. Individual debtor relief did not come into force until 1898 with the Bankruptcy Act of that year. And since 1898, we've had discharge of individual debts. But the extent to which there was discharge of individual debts has varied over time. The high point of debt forgiveness, discharge of individual debts, was the 1978 Bankruptcy Code. And ever since 1978, the discharge has been significantly eroded, periodically, incrementally, but consistently eroded. So, for example, in 1978, student loans were totally dischargeable, like any other loan. A few years later, they were made non-dischargeable on an immediate basis if they hadn't been outstanding for 5 years. That was extended to 7 years. It always applied initially only to government-guaranteed loans. But now, as of 2005, all student loans, government-guaranteed or not, are non-dischargeable forever, unless the debtor can meet a very strong burden of showing that it would be an undue hardship to repay the loan. And undue hardship, in the way many judges have looked at it, basically requires quadriplegia. If you have any potential for ever making any money in the future, then it's not an undue hardship to pay.
So think about that for a moment, because looking around the room, some of you are my age, maybe. When we were growing up, there wasn't for-profit colleges. There was college, right? You went to a state university. If you were lucky, you went to a private college, a private university, maybe you got a scholarship. So it would be interesting, Judge Weedoff, to track that timeline, which is entirely, of course, accurate, with the rise of for-profit colleges, because that's all about what it says. It says it right in what it is, profit. It's all about profit. It's got nothing to do with the underlying goals of debt forgiveness linked to the concept of education, which goes back to what Rabbi Friedman was saying, the interconnectedness of the macroeconomic good for society along with the moral correctness of forgiving debt.
Now, there's another thing that's been going on at the same time.
Are you feeling really uncomfortable yet?
We got a ways
to go.
It's going to get worse.
A massive increase in the amount of secured debt. When I was a child, someone who wanted to buy a home would always put down a substantial deposit, and signing that mortgage was one of the most serious things you would ever do, and it would require enormous background checks, and the lender would have to be very certain that you'd be able to repay that loan. If you wanted to buy a car, you generally saved up enough money until you could pay cash for the car. Well, now things are totally different. There are home equity loans. There are 0% down loans. There are cars where you buy them and you get money together with the car. So that people have enormous secured debt, and our ability to deal with that secured debt on the personal level is severely restricted. Whereas the major financial players can strip down their secured loans to the value of the collateral, an individual debtor cannot do that with a home, and now most likely can't do it with a car either. In order to keep the home or keep the car, you must pay the full amount of the loan. This is not debt forgiveness. This does not help the individual get a fresh start. And the strange thing is, when someone is overburdened with debt, if a person is facing the prospect of never having free cash to do anything else other than repay the loan, that person is very discouraged from getting married, very discouraged from getting an education that will better the person's lot, very discouraged from having children. And so the economic climate of the entire country becomes much colder. There's much less economic activity capable of taking place. And so the community as a whole suffers as we make the poorer members of the community suffer.
I think that, look, we're a little bit ahead of ourselves here, but I think Judge Wiedoff's point is correct. There are a lot of studies, and you've probably read them, that household formation is being diminished because of the student loan phenomena. And by the way, this is the reason why we all have 40-year-olds living in our basements, 30-year-olds, 50-year-olds. And the statistics of the number of folks that have that is extraordinarily high. I think it's approaching 50% of families have some adult children living with them. But let's just go back one drop. Before we get into the horrors of 2005, here's what I'd like for everybody to understand. We began biblically. We seem to be on the right page. Right, Ray Friedman. We started out.
Seems better to me than what we've got now.
Yeah, you know, we were okay. We kind of understood debt had to be forgiven for both moral and economic reasons. And we, by the time it got to 1978, the modern bankruptcy code adopted in 78 was really a major revolution. It created bankruptcy judges, who are real judges, by the way, no matter what anybody says. And it was because there's a tension between us and
not so-called judges.
Another topic for another. It's got to do with Article 3 of the Constitution, but we're not going to get into that. I think they're the best judges around. And the law functioned quite beautifully. I mean, I was practicing bankruptcy law in 78, and I was quite amazed at how well it functioned. I was very proud of it. And I saw the bankruptcy bar grow from kind of an undergrowth or whatever to a very high-powered, important bar. And it really wasn't until 2005, and I happened to be in a law firm that did a lot of the lobbying for MasterCard, and I had lunch with a lot of the people who did that lobbying, and I know exactly what their view was of debtors, and I know exactly how they felt about Elizabeth Warren, and I knew exactly why they thought that poor people were poor. And you all heard the comment about, you know, if they wanted to pay their medical bills, why are they buying cell phones? And that dialogue was, in fact, true. And I lived it and I heard it. But before we get to that, because that the reason I point out these time periods, we weren't always like this. You know, we weren't like this biblically. We weren't like this in the 70s and the 80s. We've really kind of just become like, we are reverting back. It's important to note, Justice Ginsburg said the other day, you know, we're cyclical. We go back and forth from one thing to another. We're really at the high point of anti-consumerism, anti-individual debt. So, Irv, why don't you talk? Irv is involved, and I'm delighted you're here. Thank you very much for coming. Because you're seeing debt collection at what I call the street level. You know, we're seeing it in court. But why don't you tell people what you're seeing and what's going on in your organization?
I'm delighted. Let me explain that I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, don't know much about bankruptcy, and not a Hebrew scholar. But I am currently chairing an organization called Tzedek DC. Tzedek from Deuteronomy, Tzedek, Tzedek, Tirduf, justice, justice, you shall pursue. And our goal is to take Jewish values and Jewish philanthropy and to represent low-income residents of the District of Columbia. And by the way, the reason the nation's capital is in the District of Columbia is because the debt that the judge talked about was repaid by the South, and the South, in return for paying the debt, got to have the nation's capital close to George Washington's estate at Mount Vernon. So, in the District of Columbia, we have a large number of low-income residents who are suffering the consequences before bankruptcy of consumer debt. In the same year that the bankruptcy code in 1978 was enacted, there was also the Fair Credit Collection Practices Act that was created. to deal with the question of abusive collection of debts. People calling, harassing, threatening, and obviously with the potential of leading to great disasters, including not only bankruptcy, but homelessness. And as I mentioned to David the other day, and he seemed surprised, the loss of a driver's license. And let me explain that and talk about that, because that's an issue not only that we are dealing with, but that is the subject of some litigation. And I wanted to describe this litigation to you, again, as Judge Chapman said, to make you uncomfortable, because I think the results in our federal courts are often unjust, and this is an example of an unjust case. In the District of Columbia, as well as many other jurisdictions, if you can't pay the judgment that is entered against you, and basically what CEDEC is dealing with is the recognition that in the District of Columbia, we have a large number of debt collectors who then file lawsuits, and the lawsuits result in default judgments. Because, in large part, 95% of the defendants in these consumer debt cases that end in default judgments, they're no lawyer. The lawyer, the defendant, the debtor, has no lawyer. And obviously in the 5% where there are lawyers, the results are very different. Either the case is dismissed, because a lot of these creditors or the purchasers of the credit, they don't have the documentation for it. So many times it's past the statute of limitations. There are other defenses that are available, but of course an unrepresented defendant has no idea about that. But in addition to the problems that result from just a default judgment and the collection on the default judgment, in the District of Columbia, it's provided that if the debt or if the judgment results from something that relates to an automobile, which includes traffic offenses or torts, accidents, and you don't pay that judgment, the law requires that the driver's license be suspended. And you can imagine what the consequences are of our driver's license being suspended, which means people who need a car to get to work or whose job is driving, they're out of work. They can't take their kids to school. They can't do the shopping. All kinds of collateral consequences. In Virginia,
they drive the car anyway because they have to.
Well, and then
they run the risk.
And then
you get arrested
for driving with a suspended license, and that's a further conviction. In Virginia, it's even worse. Because there, any judgment judgment that results in any fines or fees or court payments that you have to make, and if you don't make it, then your driver's license is suspended. Recently, it's only 2 weeks ago, the Federal District Court in Virginia issued a decision. This is what happened. There was an individual. He has lymphoma. He's homeless. He's out of work. He has traffic tickets, and he can't pay his traffic tickets. As a result, his driver's license was suspended. He filed a class action on behalf of all of the tens of thousands of people in Virginia whose driver's license were suspended. He sued the commissioner of the Department of Motor Vehicles. The federal district court threw this case out. By the way, I should mention that the Obama Department of Justice filed a brief in connection with a statement of interest in this case, saying that the plaintiff was right, that this practice violates due process because there's no opportunity for the poor defendant to explain that he has no money. And that's the reason that he hasn't paid his court fees. And if you can't pay it, it's not fair to take away the license which the person needs for his livelihood. Sued the commissioner of motor vehicles, which ultimately, of course, has the license and the license suspended. The court threw it out because it said you sued the wrong defendant. You sued the wrong defendant because the real defendant should be the court. because it's the court, under the statute that Virginia has enacted, it says that the court, after you don't pay your fees, shall suspend the license and send the information to the Department of Motor Vehicles. Now, of course, then they cite the Rooker-Feldman doctrine that the federal courts don't sit in judgment of the state courts, and your remedy is to go back to state court and go through the process, and then you can get up to the Supreme Court, but leave the federal courts out of it. But of course, what's really involved here is not a judgment by the court. It's the statute of Virginia that provides that automatically, without any procedure or without any right to a hearing, the debtor loses his license. And of course, the person that you can remedy with is the Commissioner of Motor Vehicles, because they have the ability to reinstate your license. So it's clear that the defendant had the right the debtor had the right defendant in that class action, but the court, and it's a 35-page opinion. They're very proud of the scholarship that turns this away. We have another case in which TSEDEC, among other things, in addition to representing individuals in particular situations, and by the way, when you represent one of these people, invariably you're able to reach a resolution that settles this debt on an ability of the debtor to pay, unlike you have a situation in the default judgment situation. But in the Fourth Circuit, and that case in the Fourth Circuit recently had this following decision interpreting the Federal Debt Collection Practices Act. The Debt Collection Practices Act, forbids harassment and improper ways of seeking to collect the debt. And since that has been enacted, there have been hundreds of millions of dollars of debts that have been purchased by third parties. They purchase it for a penny or even less than a penny on the dollar, and then their business is to go and collect the debt and get whatever they can get for it. Obviously, it was intended that those people also be covered by that statute. But in a case in the Fourth Circuit, also decided recently, where now there's a cert petition that has been granted and that we have filed an amicus brief, the Fourth Circuit, in its wisdom, said, no, well, these people who are purchasing the debt are not covered by the that statute, because the statute has two different definitions. One is of the creditor, the person who originated the credit, and the statute, the legislative history makes clear, they weren't so worried about the creditor because they thought the creditor would have future connections with the debtor and they would be a little bit sensible in how they approached it. But those who were collecting on behalf of the debtor, who were not going to have any further relation or no relation at all, they would be the harassers. So the court, in its judgment, said, well, these people, Santander is the company which purchases hundreds of millions of dollars of debt each year at incredibly low prices, they're not covered because the statute says you can't do these things when you're collecting the debt for another. And they said, well, they're not collecting for another because since they purchased it, they're collecting for themselves. Well, clearly what they meant when they said for another was the originator, the original creditor. You're collecting for someone that where you originally had the debt somewhere else. But they weren't thinking of the purchase of the debt and these abusive practices to be employed. So there's a split in the circuit, and we're going to be arguing in the Court of Appeals, in the Supreme Court, on getting the Fourth Circuit reversed. But I cite this. The judge said you want to make people uncomfortable. The law is being used, and it should make us all uncomfortable, and those who believe in Jewish values should be trying to help these debtors avoid these terrible collateral consequences that result from consumer debts that we all have. So that's what I'm saying.
So just to pick up on that, there to defend the judiciary a little bit, in New York, we have had a couple cases recently in which, to follow on what Irv said, and to pick up on the concept of discharge. So after you get a discharge, you know, you have a number of credit cards because if you're poor, you do what you have to do in order to put food on the table. So when in your mailbox comes an offer for a new credit card and it says you can transfer the balance from one to the other, you're not reading all that fine print about how it's going to cost you money to do the transfer. All you know is that you're going to get more credit. So you're going to do that. So when it finally catches up with you and you file for bankruptcy and you get a discharge, you're supposed to get a fresh start. Discharge is supposed to mean what it says. So if you are a large corporation, I'll give you an example, American Airlines, you go into bankruptcy, people line up to lend you money, you reorganize, you get massive amounts of your debt discharged and written off your balance sheet. Those planes keep flying. The executives get bonuses. Okay? Who gets to take cuts? The stewardesses, the mechanics, the pilots, who only have your life in their hands when they're flying the plane, so it's not that big a deal. They go on, they succeed now. They're doing great. Now, you're that consumer who got all those credit cards in the mail. Now, there's litigation over the fact that after you get the discharge, there's nothing that specifically requires the credit card company to go into your credit report and note that the debt has been discharged. So what's the effect of that? It affects your credit score. When your credit score is affected, it's harder for you to get credit. So you're trying to dig out, and all of these forces keep pushing you down. There's now litigation in my court over the fact that the refusal of the credit card company, in Irv's example, the issuer of the original debt, not when it's two or three times down the road, has to correct your credit card. And what is a credit card, your credit report? And what does a credit card company say? You'll love this. In the fine print in your credit card state account agreement, it says any dispute between you and me has to go to arbitration. Can't go to court. So the credit card companies now say, no. You may have gotten a discharge of the debt from that judge, but this is a problem between you and me. We're going to go to an arbitrator. And one of my colleagues has said, no way. And it's going up an appeal. It's not clear how it will come out, but it's an example of how the poor cannot catch a break. They cannot get out from under it. We could spend easily another hour going through the problems of the unbanked.
You wouldn't deal with the federal judges. I would like to make one comment that deals with what is currently going on, which I read Dana Milbank in this morning's post, which describes the confirmation hearing of Mr. Gorsuch as looking at Eddie Haskell, because I think that there's a lot of truth to that. The judge is saying, and has said repeatedly, that you know he's there only to apply the law, and any good judge is going to be sorry about the results of cases, that some cases are just going to make you sad, but that's the way it is. And, of course, I mean, he's the same one who left the who dissented when the truck driver was in 14 degrees below zero and leaves the cabin, gets warm. He should be fired, according to him, and he also proposed to cut off funding to Planned Parenthood, even though he wasn't even on the panel. But I've thought about this issue of the judges following the rule of law, and then I looked at the judicial oath of the that federal judges take, and the oath says, "We promise to administer justice without regard to the rich or poor." It doesn't say that we intend to follow the law strictly and adhere to the law. Says we administer justice. And in the cases I've described, I don't see how those decisions result in justice and how those judges think that they have done justice when they reach results that are so draconian on the litigants before them.
I want to talk about an overriding issue that came up earlier today, and that is this distinction between morality and the letter of the law. The genius of the Jewish tradition that we've been talking about is a working through of the principles of the law to come up with specific determinants of conduct so that we have definitions of what should be done in any given situation that are a matter of the law. So we've bridged the gap between morality on one hand and the letter of the law on the other. To the extent we can do that, we have greater justice and greater righteousness. Now, it may only be a coincidence, but the two people most responsible for the language of the 1978 bankruptcy code were both Jews.
Mm-hmm. Just
Richard
saying.
Lovin, Kenneth Lee.
Just saying.
Just saying.
And I believe they did a remarkable job. But there are economic interests that are contrary to this notion. Now, I think misguided, but economic interests contrary to that notion that have prevailed ever since 1978. And I would like it if the energy that's generated by the discomfort that Judge Chapman wants us all to feel, and I share that discomfort, that energy is generating some activity that changes what the letter of the law is. Judges should not ideally be in a position of either having to ignore the letter of the law or do justice.
I want to ask this one question of the two. We have two judges here. Do you accept the notion that Judge Gorsuch has said that any good judge has got to be sad about several of the results? That you go home and you're really upset that you could not do justice. You had to follow the law.
Well, but sometimes, I said wrong prematurely. I think it's entirely wrong and naive, and many of you haven't gone to law school. He said, I'm not an algorithm, okay? There is, my job is not to look up the law and say, oh, look, here's the law, here's the answer. A case gets to us because it's unclear. So the notion that you are apolitically and objectively following a manual on how to assemble, you know, a widget or a piece of furniture is ridiculous.
Precisely.
It's naive, and it's this myth that, frankly, I'm not supposed to engage in political speech, but I will because it's just us. That people mostly on the right invoke to criticize people on the left that were activist judges. Am I an activist judge? I don't believe so. Every day I try to follow the law, but I every day try to do justice. There are some times where there's nothing that I can do, and I will go home and I will cry. You get to the point where I have strong-armed, I have begged, I've cajoled, I've asked the creditor, give them money to move, give them an apartment in your other building.
Then must the creditor be merciful?
Exactly.
You know, there are cases, but
you are trying to administer justice.
Trying, you know.
So
yes.
I'm curious, in those cases, do you feel like the problem is the law, or is the problem the people who are involved in the case? And then my next level question is therefore what's the solution? Is the solution that we need to change the law, or there are different interests at stake?
It goes beyond what the law can fix. It's a societal problem. It goes beyond what the law can fix. You have a building in the Bronx where there are 500 open housing violations. So somebody comes in and they file the case to get away from what the housing court is going to do. I say, that's nice. You're here. Have a seat. I'm taking you, the landlord, the owner, out of control, and I'm going to put somebody else in. It requires money. It requires the cooperation of city agencies. It just requires requires a holistic look at IRF for this, because I'm sure his office practices in a holistic way. It requires a holistic approach. The problems are greater than what simply the law or the judge
Absolutely.
Can address. But it fundamentally requires, and I'm going to miss my train, so if I have to pay extra, I'm going to tell you. It requires a reversal of this premise that poor people are slackers, that they don't want to work, okay? That there's an implicit moral judgment against poor people in this country who, let's face it, are disproportionately minorities. And that is reflected in the malevolence that we see in the law and the application of the law. And that's the problem that has to be addressed. There's a presumption, and it's daunting to be on a panel with Gene Weedoff because he knows he is probably the most learned on consumer bankruptcies, and I am not. I do big bankruptcies. I'm presiding over the Lehman Brothers case. I am the person cleaning up that mess from 2008. But there's a presumption in law, for example, that purchases made within 90 days of when you file for bankruptcy are abusive. And there is a practice among these debt collectors of sending threatening letters to debtors that say, hey, I see you have a bill here from Costco from 45 days ago. They presume that it was for a flat screen TV. Well, it may not have been a flat screen TV. It may have been an air conditioner because they live in a fourth floor walk up and they have a heart condition, so they need an air conditioner. There's a pervasive presumption that poor people are slackers and that they don't want to work. And that's an answer to your question, Irv. I can't solve everything. I don't have a magic wand. I don't have a money printing press. And I do have to respect my authority, because without the rule of law, we don't have anything.
I apologize, but I have
All
to
right, well,
run.
And well, I think we have run out of time, but thank you, Mike. It was a fabulous discussion. And we're going to have
You are doing wonderful work.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.